Canada has this image internationally of great defender of human rights violations, the protector of human rights throughout the world. But its own backyard, it's violated the rights of the First Peoples indiscriminately for years and years. And the greatest human rights violation has been the imposition of the residential school experience.
This has been a difficult, inspiring, and very painful journey for all of us. The residential school experience is clearly one of the darkest, most troubling chapters in our collective history. In the period from Confederation until the decision to close residential schools was taken in this country in 1969, Canada clearly participated in a period of cultural genocide.
Justice Murray Sinclair, delivering Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission's final report last month. For over 100 years, Canada had a policy of removing Indigenous children as young as 6 years old from their families and placing them in residential schools, run jointly by the churches and the government. Known as Indian residential schools, they were frequently located a long way from Indian lands, making it difficult, if not impossible, for children to return home. The stated aim of the policy was to assimilate Indigenous children into white society. But as we'll learn, it was a policy that failed and destroyed many lives in the process. Over the past 6 years, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada, led by Justice Sinclair, has heard from the survivors of this school system. The Commission concluded that the policy of placing Indigenous children in residential schools was a form of cultural genocide. Hello, this is Rear Vision on RN and via the ABC app. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we trace the story of the Indian residential schools and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that has exposed the truth. While there are similarities between Canada's colonial history and what happened here in Australia, there are also some major differences, as David MacDonald explains. David is Professor of Political Science at the University of Guelph in Canada and an expert in comparative Indigenous genocide.
One of the differences is that the colonization of Canada took place earlier. So you have basically the 1500s and 1600s. You've got French explorers and colonists setting up shop around Quebec and different places in the St. Lawrence. And then you have a fur trade and a trade in other sorts of commodities developing where Aboriginal peoples are actually, in some respects, partners with some of the white colonists because they're trapping and they're trading. And this follows centuries of trading routes and things that Aboriginal peoples had before the Europeans came. So the Europeans in some ways kind of slot themselves into this. And then there's a great demand in Europe for beaver fur and various other kinds of things that Aboriginal peoples are trapping and trading with in North America, or as it's also called, Turtle Island.
When Europeans and primarily British people started to come to the northern part of North America in the 16th and 17th century, they had a interaction with Indigenous peoples that was one of mutual support.
Greg Younging, former Assistant Director of Research for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, and now Program Coordinator for the Indigenous Studies Program at the University of British Columbia.
Many people say that the early settlers would not have been able to survive here without the help of the Indigenous peoples with the harsh climate. Particular skills and knowledge needed to obtain food for hunting and harvesting. So the original relationship was one of coexistence. And in 1763, there had been some military conflicts between the British and the Indigenous nations and between the British and French as well. But Britain was losing military conflicts with Indigenous nations in 1763. There was an Odawa chief by the name of Chief Pontiac who had made allies with leaders from other Indigenous nations and was going around trying to maintain their Aboriginal title over their territories and try to fight against the encroachment of the British that was going on. And early in 1763, Chief Pontiac and his allies took over 7 British forts and British troops surrendered to Indigenous nations. The response from that, from the British Crown, was what was called the Royal Proclamation in 1763 when King George III basically set down the law on how British subjects could acquire land in British North America. It recognized the relationship between the Crown and the indigenous nations, and it set out a process that their lands could not be taken away with them without a due process. And so a treaty process began in the 1800s through even through to the early 1900s. There were at least 12 treaties signed. And what these treaties were indigenous nations giving up portions of their traditional territories in exchange for treaty rights. I know there's a common misperception that the treaty process was the indigenous nations giving up all of their territories, but they only gave up portions. And the land delineations were set out in quite detail in the treaties.
Things begin to change, especially after Canada becomes a country. So after about 1867, what you have is a government which is now trying to build a coherent country from one side of the continent to the other. And they're also trying to get as much land as they can so they can get Europeans and others to come settle in what will become Canada. So rather than seeing Aboriginal peoples as partners, they begin to see them as being people that have land that the Canadian government wants to acquire. But the residential schools are an aspect of this idea that the British government and then the Canadian government should be able to control the land and also the other kinds of resources as well. So the residential schools come about in part because the government signs a number of treaties with Aboriginal peoples, largely to get a hold of their land. And there's a lot of trickery involved in this, as there is in New Zealand and elsewhere, where there are oral agreements reached with different leaders in the different First Nations, but the actual documents that are signed, or in some cases not signed, are very, very different from the oral understanding that the leaders had. Part of the treaties has to do with schooling for the people that are on these lands. Many of the First Nations leaders want their people to be able to have the best of both worlds. They want to retain their own traditions, their own culture, their own land and spiritual values, but they also want to be able to know enough about the sort of culture that the white man is bringing that they are able to adapt to a certain extent. The residential schools develop in part because of processes that go on in the U.S. And I think it's 1879, a school at an old military barracks in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, is converted into one of the first residential schools for Aboriginal children, or Native American children, as they're called south of the border. And that model becomes used by various Canadian officials who like the idea of taking children and teaching them either English or French and trying to civilize them, in quotation marks. One of the big differences between Canada and the U.S. is that the U.S. education system is more secular. It's more run by the state. In Canada, it's largely run by the churches. So 60% of the schools are run by the Catholics. Then you have the Anglicans, the Presbyterians, and others running the remainder of those schools.
According to Greg Younging, the Indian residential schools have to be seen in the context of the Indian Act.
A Canadian law, which exists to this day, called the Indian Act, was written in 1876, and it established how Indigenous peoples would live on reserves, who would be considered Indigenous, how they had to govern themselves and not with their traditional governments, how the Department of Indian Affairs, which was a federal department, established to administer the Act. So one of the responsibilities was to educate Indigenous peoples, whereas other Canadians are the responsibility falls under the provinces. So there was a report done called the Davin Report. It was released in 1879, a couple of years after the Indian Act. And this report contained findings about how Indigenous peoples should be educated based on this model of assimilation and colonization. And there were some statements made that it was impossible to assimilate Indigenous peoples unless you remove them from their families and communities. And children had to be caught young in order to be civilized. There were some very famous statements made at the time about the assimilation policy, in which the residential school system really was the hallmark of. For example, the first Prime Minister of Canada, John A. Macdonald, said in 1877, "The great aim of our legislation has been to do away with the tribal system and assimilate the Indian people in all respects with other inhabitants of the Dominion as speedily as they are fit for the change." So Nicholas Davin proposed this residential school system where schools would be run jointly by the federal government and the churches. Basically, all the churches that were in Canada at the time during the residential school era participated in the residential school system along with the federal government. So the schools were often intentionally situated far from reserves. So the idea was to isolate the Indigenous children from the age of six, when they were taken away from their parents and communities and brought to these schools. And the idea behind these Indian residential school system was to remove the influence of the parents and the grandparents, cut off the children's access to their traditional knowledge, their traditional institutions, and even their families and communities and their territories. So the system operated between about the 1890s until the 1970s, when it began to wind down. So in some parts of Canada, five generations of children were abducted and went through this system. Although the system started to wind down in the 70s, the last residential school actually didn't close until 1996.
In a lot of cases, they were located quite a distance from the different reserve lands. That was on purpose. It was deliberate, because the idea was to basically take these children away from their families, from their home communities, to basically isolate them, and as I've argued elsewhere, to try to beat the Indian out of them, to make them into some sort of very different kind of person from what they would have been otherwise. So they were located a distance away. You have lots of letters from principals and also the Department of Indian Affairs saying that they don't even want the parents or the community visiting these kids. They also try to keep a lot of them in the schools during the holidays so that they won't go back to their families and lose some of the kind of indoctrination that they get. So the kids would come to the schools. They were often very large and imposing buildings. So a lot of the survivors will talk about how they were very intimidated by the size of these buildings, by how sort of dark and menacing they often looked. The children were then often beaten. I was listening to one account today where at the St. Anne's School, which is in Northern Ontario, where within 2 minutes of being in the school, this one child who was seven was beaten and thrown against a wall by a nun. And so it was quite a brutal system. The idea was basically to get the Indian children to become something entirely different, to give up their names, their languages, their spirituality, everything, and to kind of become a second-rate European settler, in a sense.
During the century the policy existed in Canada, well over 100,000 Indigenous children were forced to attend around 139 residential schools. But unlike other schools in Canada, the Indian residential schools were not well-resourced.
At a certain point, because the schools were so poorly funded, they had to generate their own income. So a lot of the schools, they had at least half a day where the kids were doing farm chores. They had chickens and they had to get the eggs. They were milking cows. They were doing all sorts of farm labor in the fields and stuff like that. Most of this stuff was either the teachers ate it or it was sold to raise money for the upkeep of the school. So at best, most of the kids were getting a half a day of education. But you get a lot of cases where kids are coming out of the school after 10 years with a grade 2 education, and some can't read and write. Most of them are just turned off from the whole idea of school. Some of them will say that they felt so incarcerated by the schools that they found prison to be very similar, if not actually better, than the residential schools that they were in. So I would say the education level was generally very low, but of course there would be a number of exceptions to that. There would be kids who were able to do okay in that system, who had a level of resilience, who maybe encountered good teachers who were trying to encourage them and that sort of thing. But another problem, too, is that a lot of the teachers didn't actually have any kind of education. They weren't trained to be teachers. They hadn't been to university. Some of them hadn't finished high school. The level of pay was much, much lower for residential schools as well. So if you were a teacher, you would do much better working in a day school in a city somewhere or a town than you would at a residential school.
So in these schools, children were punished for displaying any aspects of their cultures. They were punished for speaking their languages. As soon as they got to these schools, they were given a haircut, same haircut. The boys given a military-style haircut, and the girls given a sort of bowl haircut with hair just above their shoulders. They all wore the same uniforms. They had to go pray every day and go to church as part of their indoctrination, and they were taught basically European history and European ideologies. And it was thought that if this went on for a few generations or more, that the children would grow up assimilated, and that didn't work.
While there, they were not allowed to speak their native languages or practice their native traditions. As well, thousands were physically, sexually, and emotionally abused. John Banksland spent 15 years at a residential school in Iqaluit.
First of all, the Grey Nuns from Montreal beat at me to the extent where I lost my language, I lost my culture, I even lost my family. I can't speak my language. I hardly know my brothers and sisters and back in Uluhaktu. But now I've learned them, who they are. And the story is the same with a lot of you survivors out there that can't remember years and years you spent in time in residential school.
There was very high levels of physical and also sexual abuse. So physical abuse ran to about 75% in some schools, sexual abuse 60% or more in a lot of these cases. So very horrific environments for the kids to be in. And from what I can tell, they were bad in the 19th century, and they continue to be bad throughout the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. I mean, when you talk to survivors of the schools who are still around, who are in their 60s and 70s, I mean, some of the stories they tell you about the 50s and 60s and so on were just horrific. But it is difficult because there was sort of a curtain of silence, I suppose you could say. People didn't want to talk about their experiences very much. It's very difficult for survivors to talk to their families or even to each other about the kinds of things which had occurred in the schools. And a lot of people that I've talked to as well have sort of blacked out these experiences. They don't want to think about them and deal with them, even though they happen to themselves. So the kind of information we have for the schools in periods where people have now died is difficult, but I would imagine they were very bad. You also have, as you probably know, various reports from the 1920s which indicated very high levels of mortality. So the schools were not very well constructed. They would often put a lot of the sick kids together. There were large cemeteries outside of the school. You have mortality rates of 50% in some cases, and a very, very sporadic death certificate. So, and a lot of certificates and other information about what went on in the schools were destroyed as well.
Well, I can tell you that in my family, I have been slowly finding out that the generation of my parents and aunts and uncles, virtually all of them were subject to at least two of those types of abuse, and some of them three. And you can imagine probably that the girls, one of the things that became apparent during the TRC work was that the sexual abuse was much more common in the girls, although there were boys who were sexually abused by nuns, but it was much more common in the girls. So I would estimate from hearing hundreds, actually 500 plus of the testimonies at the TRC during my work there, and also being familiar with and knowing a lot of residential school survivors, well over 50% of boys suffered at least two of those kinds of abuses. I would say well over 60 or 70% of the girls suffered all three types of abuses. And that's just an estimation. The TRC collected 7,000 testimonies, and the data in those testimonies still needs to be analysed.
You're listening to Rear Vision on RN and via your ABC radio app. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we're tracing the story of the Indian residential schools and the ongoing damage the system caused to the Indigenous community of Canada.
I spent 10 years in two residential schools. I spent 10 years away from my family and my community, and before all of my older siblings, younger ones, my mom and dad, my grandmother on my father's side. I mean, she died when she was 82 in 1954, and she'd been to an industrial school. What this policy was about was the denial of our cultures, our languages, our history, or histories. And it's a tragic chapter that is largely unknown in the history of Canada. And it's remained as a footnote, not as something that's studied in our schools. So people don't understand and appreciate this tragedy and the consequences of this experience.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we have deplorable social conditions in Indigenous communities and families that are... Another element I didn't mention previously was the suicide rate. We have 10 times the suicide rate of non-Indigenous peoples in Canada. So the impact was, when they grew up to be adults, they had no example of loving, being brought up with love. And when they had their own families, they had no parenting models to go by either because they weren't parented. So they didn't know how to parent. They didn't know how to love. Plus, the cycles of abuse were played out from generation to generation. So if you were abused as a child, you might tend to abuse your own child or other people around you in your family. So we've had this immense family psychological breakdown that we're really just, as indigenous communities and nations, we're really just coming out of. You know, I'm the first generation of my family who didn't go to residential schools, but I'm an intergenerational survivor because, you know, my parents had a lot of difficulty bringing me up. Actually, personally, I had a much better upbringing. Actually, I had a good loving upbringing, I would even say then. But I'm the exception to the rule. Most people in my generation who are first generation intergenerational survivors have not had very good upbringings. And there's sort of a widespread acknowledgement going on across the country now that that's not their parents' fault, and that children have to forgive their parents for not having been able to bring them up as well as they should have been able to, including providing for them and giving them all the opportunities a child and a teenager should have.
So did non-Indigenous people in Canada know or understand what was going on in these residential schools?
No, I don't think they did. And that's something the TRC has been writing about too. Most people didn't really have a sense of what was going on. And supposedly some of the teachers in the schools didn't really know the full extent of what was going on either. I think people knew something was wrong. Something was really wrong, but they didn't really maybe have the lenses to figure out what was going on. Because of the racism of the time and because of the way the school systems operated, most of the sort of the settler population would have felt that there was something wrong with Aboriginal peoples, that there was something wrong with their cultures, their languages, that they just weren't adapting properly to Western civilization. So there was a great tendency to blame Aboriginal peoples for the problems that were taking place, and very little sense of maybe the schools are to blame or other things like that. So it's really only been since maybe the mid-80s that the residential schools have really been looked at as and understood to any great extent. And again, part of it is because the survivors didn't really want to talk about it either. So they were embarrassed and often ashamed by what had occurred to them at the schools. There wasn't a lot of information out there. Justice Sinclair, who's the chief commissioner of the TRC, only found out a couple years ago even that his father had been to residential schools and had been abused. He didn't even know, and he was in charge of the TRC. So this shows you the extent to which people really often kept secrets from their families about this, what was going on.
In 2008, Prime Minister Stephen Harper apologized on behalf of the Canadian government for its role in the residential school system. Along with the apology came hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation for the victims, some of whom waited for it for decades. And as part of the settlement, there was a pledge to hold national hearings across the country so that survivors could tell their stories and perhaps find closure in the process. The hearings were also a way to educate all Canadians about this little-known chapter of their history.
The Government of Canada sincerely apologizes and asks the forgiveness of the Aboriginal peoples of this country for failing them so profoundly.
What basically was going on was that a lot of the survivors were taking the government to court, or the churches to courts. There were a whole lot of court cases going on in the 1990s. And eventually what you have are class actions taking place, where different law firms like the Merchant Law Group in Saskatchewan and other law firms are getting large numbers of survivors, sometimes thousands of survivors together in these enormous class action suits against the government. So the government basically realized that it would be having to pay out billions and billions and billions of dollars. So what they did was they sat down with representatives of the survivors and others and came up with what was called the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement. So part of the settlement agreement was that the survivors would be compensated for what had happened to them in the school. So there was monetary compensation. There was money set aside for different kinds of healing and things like that. But the survivors also wanted to have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They wanted to be able to tell their stories of what happened, that this material would be gathered together as a matter of public record so that this sort of thing would not happen again. Part of that agreement, too, envisaged the creation of a national research center where all the documents collected by the TRC would be housed. And there's currently about 4 million digitalized documents and now about 7,000 oral interviews. So it's the largest oral history project in the world, as far as I know. So that was the idea. And so the TRC basically from 2009 went around. They held 7 national events and 1 final event, and a lot of regional events as well. So the different provinces would host these large gatherings where somewhere between 3 and 10,000 people would show up over 4 or 5 days. There would be a big stage where people would tell the stories of what happened to them in residential school in a very public setting where they would receive support from the audience. There were also private statements as well, so people could go in with health support and give private statements as well. And all of this stuff was recorded, was archived, and much of it will be available for future researchers as well.
It's been a platform for Indigenous peoples to rebuild communities and nations, go back to traditions, go back to traditional institutions. For Canadian people, it's been a realization that the federal government has acted atrociously in the past and done major damage to the First Peoples of this territory. And so there's a movement of Canadian people who support Indigenous peoples and want to ally with Indigenous peoples and, you know, work towards this reconciliation. And I think that will just build and build, and we'll have to see where it takes us.
During the 6 years the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or TRC, has been in existence, it's collected over 6,000 statements and recorded over 1,000 hours of testimony. In its final report, which was released last month, it set out 94 recommendations.
One of them was that the Pope apologized for the Catholic role in the residential schools. There's meant to be kind of a commission or board which will oversee the recommendations and see if they're implemented. There's stuff about increased funding for Aboriginal languages, for education, much more scrutiny over the way Aboriginal peoples are treated in the justice system, which is absolutely horrific. A lot of emphasis on education at the primary, secondary, and university level, and in other ways, so that everybody understands the legacies of the residential schools and why the relationship between settlers and Aboriginal peoples is the way it is. There's also a strong interest in honoring the treaties which have not been honored in Canada, reinvigorating this Royal Proclamation that I talked about earlier of 1763, which recognized basically the sovereignty and nationhood of First Nations peoples. And very important too, and much of this is framed in this way, is through the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. So the commissioners have stated very clearly that they see that as a very important document going forwards in terms of promoting reconciliation.
Can Canada, or the relationship between the Indigenous people and the non-Indigenous people in Canada, ever be the same?
I don't think it can. Now that the truth is out, there's no question to me that we have to move in the direction of self-determination for Indigenous peoples, increase land masses, Indigenous traditional institutions, including Indigenous governments, be reinstated and recognized, that there be territories, some sections of Indigenous territories where Indigenous peoples have complete legal control and authority to make their own laws and to govern themselves and the resources on those lands. Reserves are way too small. We've had several reports recognize that. So the land masses have to be increased. The Indigenous controlled lands have to be increased. And the control that Indigenous peoples have in those territories has to be increased, which means Canadians are going to have to give up some of their lands and some of their control over resources. And they're just going to have to get used to that.
Greg Younging, former Assistant Director of Research for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. My other guest, David MacDonald, Professor of Political Science at the University of Guelph. Today's sound engineer is Russell Stapleton. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN.